Welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Many people are uncomfortable with death. At the very least, people tend not to want to leave the pleasures of earthly life. Many cultures incorporate the dead into the life of the living through ceremony, and some cultures believe in an afterlife. Often ignored is the very real biological way that all creatures, including humans, are made of the stuff of life, and upon their death are returned to life by being recycled into the soil and even the air. In this way, there is no end, there is only transformation. In nature, all things get reused to make more life. Modern humans have interfered with this cycle by preserving bodies and burying them deeply in the ground where they can't feed anything. Cremation is burning a body, and that's a waste of enormous amounts of fossil fuels, and it produces high carbon smoke. Our relationship to our world, our forests, trees, soil, and air may be our undoing, but humans are industrious, and increasingly we are learning from nature how to contribute to the balance of the earth's abundance. We are of the earth, and our practices should feed the earth and return the favor for all we've been given. In this way, there truly is no death, just more life. Stay with us for a discussion of the book Life Everlasting, where we learn how to use everything to create more life. First, some thoughts from Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. The American Chemical Society maintains the most comprehensive database of commercial chemicals in the United States. 15,000 new chemicals are registered to the database not every year, not every month, not every week, but every day. 15,000 per day. We're exposed to these chemicals directly through the products that use them, such as personal care products, as well as incidental exposure, such as agricultural drift containing pesticides and herbicides. For decades, scientists have become concerned about how these chemicals find their way into water, soil, and air by pathways such as wastewater systems. For example, when people urinate out pharmaceuticals or dump drugs down the sink or toilet. The concentration of such chemicals in the environment is extremely low compared to direct exposures by factors of hundreds of thousands or even hundreds of millions. After release into the environment, some chemicals find their way into plants and animals and us. Because of advances in monitoring technology, it's possible to detect these background exposures in concentrations never before possible, according to environmental health scientist Deborah Swackhamer of the University of Minnesota. Quote, "We don't know what these background levels mean in terms of environmental or public health." End quote. Remember that "we don't know" means we don't know. It does not mean it's safe to be exposed. So once again, we are the subjects of an uncontrolled, involuntary medical experiment. A few years ago, I reported on the effect of Prozac in ultra-minute amounts. Researchers found that background levels of that famous serotonin reuptake inhibitor killed off Great Lakes bacteria. What does that mean for our own gut bacteria, from either a dose of the drug or from a chronic exposure to background levels in our drinking water? We already know that our gut bacteria have a crucial role in our physical and mental health, working not only on digestion and nutrition, but on immunity and mood. Our gut produces something like 40% of the neurotransmitter serotonin, the levels of which Prozac inhibits by blocking serotonin's reabsorption. A recent literature review in the journal Bioessays discusses how gut microbes affect the eating behavior of their hosts, that's you and me, in order to get the food they need. This is a novel perspective because it's not just about what physiological function gut bacteria perform, it's about those functions from the bacteria's perspective. It is, actually, an ecological perspective. Not as metaphors so that you'll treat your microbiome with care, but as an actual description of how you live with other creatures, essential to your health and theirs. The mechanism is this. If you eat something a microbe species doesn't like, it produces biochemicals that have negative mood and taste effects. If you eat something a microbe species likes, it does the opposite, biochemicals that have positive mood and taste effects. From an ecological perspective, this is a classic strategy for the evolution and stability of an ecosystem. Everyone gets what they want to eat, with some tolerance or resistance from other members of the community. Another feature of the relationship between eating behavior and gut microbes is that microbe diversity and composition are closely associated with host diet, nutrition, and energy metabolism, for example, body weight and composition. To connect this to the Prozac thread, note that the phenomenon of obesogens, chemicals associated with weight gain, was first observed in people taking antidepressants, in particular serotonin reuptake inhibitors such as Prozac. So here's the question. What effect does exposure to these 15,000 chemicals per day have on our microbiome? And what effect does that have on our health generally, not just our eating habits? We don't know. And those who are asking tend to ask fairly narrow questions, although they seem huge. I've already mentioned the effect of background Prozac concentrations on Great Lakes bacteria. The Decrepit Toxic Substances Control Act has researchers performing outmoded risk assessments on individual chemicals. I haven't mentioned the little bit we know about what happens when someone is exposed to multiple chemicals, or what happens when a chemical released into the environment transforms into some other chemical that might be more dangerous or less dangerous, we don't know, or what happens from exposures to background electromagnetic radiation, ionizing, for example, from nuclear power plants, or non-ionizing, for example, from smartphones, or combined exposures to radiation and chemicals. We don't know. But I digress. You could conclude that you're swimming in a toxic soup. That's not the point I want to make. I want to draw your attention to the fact that from an environmental health and public health standpoint and your body's own health standpoint, those 15,000 chemicals per day need to be seen as an ecological problem. What I mean is that it is grossly inadequate to perform a risk assessment that tells us that concentrations of one of those 15,000 chemicals will kill half the population of lab animals. That's a basic benchmark in risk assessment. That tells us nothing. What it does is allow regulators to permit a chemical's use and for us to be mollified with fairy tales about its safety. We still don't know what the effect is on life, the society of organisms that live their lives together, its members variously tolerating, resisting, avoiding, and supporting each other, evolving and sustaining itself through time. A transcript is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and he produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Our guest today is Bernd Heinrich. He is an acclaimed scientist and author of numerous award-winning books, including the best-selling The Mind of the Raven, Why We Run, Winter World. Today we're discussing his book, Life Everlasting, and he has a new book out called The Homing. He's a frequent contributor to national media and a professor emeritus of biology at the University of Vermont. And we're so pleased to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, I do need you to speak up a bit.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So your book, Life Everlasting, it looks to the way that nature, naturally, you know, what happens in nature with animals and insects and birds, and how life returns to, you know, after death, how all material in life is returned to create new life, that all of death is a return to home, essentially. And I'd like you to talk about that.
Yes, I'm trying to show the interconnectedness of all of life. So it's one life melds into another life. So there, any birth requires death, and there is a continuum. And so, you know, I'm a kind of a biologist, so I kind of look at transformations anyways. the usual transformations that one looks at as a biologist tends to be something like the mechanisms of how maybe a caterpillar transforms into a butterfly, but the thing is that the caterpillar can turn it. You can have a caterpillar, and I used to raise caterpillar. It was a lot of fun, and I'd get sometimes a big Ichneumon wasp out of one, and sometimes maybe I'd get, you know, like 20 or 30 little tiny wasps of some other kind out of one caterpillar. And of course, you would call this parasitism, but you know, sometimes a fly comes out instead. So when we look at the end result, we see, you know, one life metamorphosing into another, the same way as potentially we might look at a tadpole turning into a frog. And you know, we have these fairy tales about the princess turning into a toad or the toad into a princess. I don't know which it is, but anyway, there's transformation. So it's not that one ends as much as another begins. So,
if I might, the thing that's fascinating about the transformation of a caterpillar into a flying insect, which happens in the book, you discuss the sphinx moth, which looks like very much like a hummingbird, actually. Mm-hmm. And the whole transformation, how this wonderful green caterpillar that disguises itself to avoid being eaten, cocoons itself and actually goes through a death. All the material that made it what it was is changed to make it this other thing.
Yes, it's basically that one set of genes, that one body dissolves, and another set of genes gets turned on in the body and uses those materials and produces another animal. So there's kind of a death of the caterpillar because it dissolves and other things grow. If you were looking at it from a different perspective, if we see a parasite who lays an egg in there, well, it's not really that much different. But then we look at it like a death and we see it as something negative. Parasitism, but you know, it's turning into something else again. So, and that happens all the time in all of life, in everything, even when things get eaten, here's a different process involved in the transformation. So, in other words, you know, if the caterpillar now gets eaten by a mantid or a spider or a bird, at least a part of it becomes that animal that eats it, becomes the physical structure of that animal, and it's reprocessed and into that animal. So happens, you know, plants being converted to living animals. Plants are living as well. So we all live another life and just get transformed.
So the problem that humans have is they have this consciousness of themselves. They have a sense of themselves, their soul, their ego, their something or rather there. There's a consciousness of this process. And people hate to let go of this, but what you're pointing to in the book is that if your life, either as you're vital and contributing, feeds other people, and is influencing other people, and you, in fact, are being influenced by other people, that if in death you're able to let go of your body and allow it to become part of the soil or part of the animals that are around, that this is, in fact, a return home, that it becomes a very profound thing that, I guess, for you has made you much less afraid of dying.
Yes, I think it's a soothing thought, you know, to look at death as the beginning of life, to see it, the physical part of the animal, of ourselves, turning into beautiful, returning home, so to speak, to where we come from, which is nature as a whole, because we are connected to all of nature, from so many directions, not only from the DNA, which we all branched from common beginnings, and also materially from a physical structure at the moment, which is constantly being renewed by other life, and we're constantly returning materials to other life. But, you know, as a biologist, I also look at it sometimes, you know, beyond the simply physical, because, you know, we think of ourselves as something beyond just physical entities. We have individual identities. We have something we call spirit. And this is something that lives on, too. I mean, we can't really define the spirit thing. But I see it kind of as information, the same way as I see DNA as information, which has been passed down to us since the very beginnings of life on Earth. And information is passed down endlessly from generation to generation in many animals as well, and especially in ourselves, where but these bits of information become incorporated into our being. And I think each of us can name, you know, many people who are direct contributors in us, who live on in us, because we have given something to them, have been close to them. And so we see that we live on more than just in the physical aspect. Of course, mm-hmm. I make a big deal out of the physical because I'm a biologist and look at that, but I see it also in the physical is in...
Yes.
Intricately connected to our individual selves as something beyond the living.
You're listening to an interview with Bernd Heinrich. His book that we're discussing today is Life Everlasting, The Animal Way of Death. One review calls it a field guide of exquisite detail and thoughtful meditation on the connectedness of all things. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. The remarkable part of this is that even as we develop, we go through all the evolutionary stages, as do other mammals. You know, when we're in mm-hmm. our mommy's tummy, turning into a fetus, we go through different stages. We're like single cell, then we divide, and we do, and so we go through the entire evolutionary cycle. Mm-hmm. And you've also mentioned in the book that our DNA. Oh, or rather our mitochondria, our energy-making part of our mm-hmm. cells, evolved from ancient bacteria. So we're kind of a work in progress, aren't we?
Well, we are a conglomerate of all of life on Earth, really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about work in progress. We are in the sense that there is no end. Everlasting, right? The life is everlasting. It goes on as it continues from one to the other in a continuous flow. And this is through evolutionary time. It is through time at the present in terms of us, of the material flow, and in terms of the information flow, which makes us. In the physical and the non-physical spheres.
One of the things that you say is that we're capable, that human beings, we don't know, we think that there are some animals that may be conscious like this, but we know that we are, and so we can see this physical resurrection and the implications of it in terms of connections, but what are our obligations and debts based on this reality?
Yeah, I think this knowledge, this unique knowledge that we have, it seems to me, does have some obligations. I mean, on the one hand, we understand how we are connected to something so remarkable and so beautiful, such as the whole of life. I mean, that should be very uplifting. You know, it's not like we just come from dust and return to dust. We come from life and return to life. So I think there's something very uplifting in that thought to me, which is not just a thought, which is a reality. But that comes with obligations. I mean that relates to not only burial, it relates to to if we know we are part of life as a whole, how does that relate to our moral stance or our spiritual stance toward life as a whole? So if we understand what the connections are we going to do something that makes that acknowledges these realities and gives us a responsibility, the same as we would normally to a family or to a group of people that we belong to. But if we belong to the whole earth, that means the same thing on a different scale.
So you contrast in the book Everlasting, you contrast how various other life forms do this, how they literally take the material of death, you know, the raw material of another creature, and they actually carry things off, you know, there's some beetles that bury the things, and then they wrap it up so it doesn't spoil too much. And then the two partners who have gone through this very arduous process of carrying something on their legs as they lay on their back and moving it to a place where they can bury it, these burying beetles, but then they mate and they lay their eggs on this these leavings, and the babies grow and eat off that and then create more life. You contrast that with the fact that in the human world that humans unfortunately have been less prudent about recycling material, and even down to not only, as you say, burial, where we bury things too deeply to be used and made into soil, we prevent that from happening, but we also do cremation, which is a lot of fuel and it dirties the air up with the smoke. It's considerable. It isn't a small thing. But in addition, we cut trees down and chip them up, and we don't let things rot and become soil. We don't allow things to feed back, to put back the raw materials. We tend not to recycle on the most basic. Forget the plastic. What about the trees? And what about all other things? You know, why do we constantly have to remove these things? So you contrast the behavior of humans as we try to learn more from nature.
Yes, I was particularly, as you mentioned, the Nycrophorus burying beetles. You know, if you just look at the surface, what you see is a dead mouse. You might think, ah, oh, yuck, you know, it's dead and gone. But you know, the beetles bury it, and a few weeks later, about a dozen beautiful beetles come emerging out of the ground. And you know, the only reason that they're there is because the mouse died, and you see something beautiful come of it, and that's because it got recycled in the natural way that works in nature. And potentially, you know, I was thinking, when I wrote the book, I was thinking of this friend of mine who had actually contacted me, and he was thinking of some of the same things. He was thinking how he would like to be reincarnated as a wraith, you know, and his physical remains flying in the sky like a raven, because they have such beautiful animals and beautiful flight, something poetic about it. And so to think of one's remains ending up as something beautiful like that is kind of uplifting. And even though nobody wants to court death, but it's going to be inevitable. So if you look at it this way, that you're actually contributing something beyond your own physical remains, that's what I was thinking. And instead, we make a cost of our having lived on other animals, such as polluting the air with all the toxins that are released, you know, due to cremation, for example, and the costs in burning up fossil fuels in order to be cremated. There are all these costs.
And then using up the land too, instead of shallow.
Using up the fossil fuels and not giving anything to the animals, the rest of the biosphere.
Yeah, there is a movement now for shallow burial, because if you bury less than, you know, somewhere in the range of 4 feet or less, then organisms will come and recycle your materials. And gosh, you know, you could even plant a tree over the place that the person has been put, and a tree will nurture itself through the remains. Yeah. You know, so and
exactly.
we don't.
And
I was just going to say, and we don't know what happens then, but the possibility is stirring. It's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's exciting that, you know, the tree, for example, is going to now nourish lots of birds. It's going to be fed on by lots of beautiful thousands of different kinds of insects. We'll be feeding birds, you know, and so it's you know, at the bottom of the food chain, near the bottom of the food chain of an incredible conglomerate of many different organisms, and you know, that will be a legacy that will live on.
In addition, you're contributing to the development of soil, and as we know from your book, soil sequesters carbon. It's where the carbon is.
Yeah.
So it's very important for there to be healthy soil everywhere on the planet, and that's part of when the tree falls, it eventually turns into soil and it feeds animals and things like that. At the other end, in the oceans, you explain the very stirring image of what happens when a whale dies. It's a long story, but you know, in the end, when it sinks to the bottom, it comes back to life. It's like a planet. It suddenly is just wriggling, and there's like hair growing on it, and there's all this, and it will feed colonies of different creatures for as long as it lived, which might be 70 years after its death.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing, wonderful image.
Can I interrupt for a minute?
Oh, no, you should go ahead.
If somebody's got a radio on down the hall, I got to tell them to shut it off. Is it...
Okay. Why don't you do that?
Unless you're not hearing it.
I'm not hearing it. Is it too distracting for you? No, we're not hearing it. Why don't you do
it?
We're going to take.
Wait,
Bernd?
Yeah.
Bernd, if you can wait another 3 or 4 minutes, we're going to take a brief musical break. So we'll do it while you're doing that, okay?
Okay.
So,
good.
So again, you know, with this wonderful example. And again, in the book, you have these beautiful stories of all these different creatures that do these remarkable. I mean, even down to insects are just amazing. I mean, there are many amazing creatures that have such amazing. They coordinate with each other. They are determined. They know where they're going. They know how to do this. And in addition, as you brought up, the ravens and the buzzards, these other carrion-eating birds are extraordinarily intelligent and communal and very inspiring as creatures.
Yes, I certainly agree. I mean, I have studied ravens for quite a few for several decades now, and at first I just wanted to know if they shared carcasses, because they're sort of the northern main scavengers of ulcers, more the southern, they have probably some of the smartest birds in the world, the ravens, and they even, you know, have a culture where they pass on behavior from one to the other to future generations, because what one learns, it passes on to the other, so the more you know about them, the more respect, at least the more. They used to be, you know, just shot on sight because people associated them with death and thought them as very negative. But instead, they are actually doing tremendous service. If one were to say that removing, you know, carcasses from the surface of the earth and letting them stink, for example. They quickly remove it, you know, and up in the Himalayas,
the Tibetans,
vultures, you know, the Tibet, the vultures remove
sky burial,
sky burial in a matter of hours. The carcass is removed, and it becomes birds.
Yeah.
But you know, the only way you can have that is you have a large population of these animals, and it takes a while for them to build up. normally they would be around, but we have denied them the food so that the populations are low, and you know, this doesn't happen instantly that you automatically have huge flocks coming in to do this, unless you, you know, you are conscious of this and provide, and for example, let's say waste material from slaughtering cows and so on, you know, could feed scavengers and
yes.
build up the population.
Yes. We're going to need to take just a brief musical break here, and we'll be right back after this, if you could stay with us. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. We're doing an interview with the author of Life Everlasting, Bernd Heinrich. Welcome back. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Find a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. So, you know, along with what you just said, which is to when an animal dies for whatever reason, it could have been in nature, in the wild somewhere, or it could have been unfortunately, you know, hurt on a road. It's also valuable not to just whisk away the body and burn it. You know, there's this practice of removing animal carcasses and burning them, which again contributes to fossil, you know, fossil fuels and carbon smoke.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But in fact, if we allow nature to do its normal cycle, and we allow these carrion animals, which incidentally you also talk about, and I got to witness this recently on the land we live on, which is how playful and intelligent and communal and communicative these animals are. These ravens, for instance, do these aerial acrobatics, and they're playful and wonderful animals. And it's so worthy. They're worthy, and they're doing a very important job.
Yeah.
So it's one of the ways that we can learn from nature and help the planet to restore itself, rebuild itself. What are some other ways that we could be better? We could do better. Well, probably not poisoning rodents too, so that the carrion birds get ill.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah.
Instead of, in many cases, instead of broadcasting pesticides for controlling the rodents. I mean, I just recently heard in Israel they had installed big bird boxes for barn owls who hunt the rodents at night, and kestrels, like little falcons, who hunt them in the daytime, and that allowed them to control the rodents who were eating the crops instead of throwing out pesticides. And which not only, you know, kill the mice, but also were killing birds, and that meant having to produce, you know, throw out more pesticides, etc.
It's not a pesticide actually; it's a poison. It's a poison that kills mammals, and it also kills the birds that eat those mammals. So along with, you know, leaving forests, allowing trees that fall in the forest to stay where they are, instead of having this sort of frantic idea about having to remove every dead twig because of fire, you're actually creating better soil and healthier forests. And the other thing that you mention in the book that's really interesting is because the soil sequesters carbon, in a situation where there is climate change, if the Arctic melts too fast, it will release an enormous amount of carbon into the air, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is also dangerous, yes?
Yes, of course. Yeah,
and you said the trees couldn't even mop it up, and the oceans couldn't mop it all up if it happened too fast.
Yeah. Of course, the trees will eventually all rot and release it all again, but then other trees will sop it up. So the real problem is the mining of fossil fuels that have accumulated and had not been released over millions and millions of years. So these are former trees. When all that got buried, normally, of course, in the forest, all the trees will actually return to carbon because they will decay at some time. And the more trees you have, the more carbon you're going to have eventually, etc. But the more carbon will be sucked up. I mean, it's a balance. So for them to be sucking up the CO2 arising from coal and oil is a temporary thing, but it's necessary.
You are, though, optimistic that human beings are capable of learning fast enough to advance and not destroy everything as they have in the past.
Well, I'm hopeful. I mean, we see a lot more awareness now that, I mean, for a very long time, I don't think we really were aware, and I think it's now coming home to roost and we're catching on what's happening. And I think, you know, there are incredible numbers of people who are conscious now, and that's the beginning, that's the start. And you know, for example, just like this radio program here, we're learning something that might have some practical applications. I mean, for example, just don't burn animal carcasses, and maybe it'll have some effect on what we think about burial. Maybe it'll have some effect of how we respect the rest of life. And so I think, you know, I am hopeful. And the thing is, we need to have a direction to go. We need to know exactly what to do. Otherwise, we're just going at cross purposes. So we need more awareness, and I think we need more education. I think we need to have more nature studies beginning in grammar school instead of just adding and subtraction and stuff like that. We need to learn about life. We need to learn about nature.
In fact, you live in a forest, as we do. Well, we live in an area with both forest and rolling hills and a river. And it's quite wild where we are, and I think where you live as well. And when you came from Germany as a child, did you not already still live in a forested area and had to live sort of on, you guys had to be hunter-gatherers, I guess, when you first arrived, huh?
Well, that's true. I mean, I remember even finding a couple of, I remember once finding a wild boar that had been killed, and due to the ravens who were making a noise, and went there to investigate. I knew something was up, and we found that, and that was very important for us. And we found an elk carcass in that forest that had been killed, and and we lived on mushrooms and berries.
Mm-hmm.
It was living close to nature, and I guess that experience left its mark. And you know, I've continued that, and tried to learn more and more about what it means for human survival and knowledge about how nature works.
Well, you are, as a biologist, and certainly primed from your childhood experience to become a biologist, you've had this need to observe closely what's going on. And I think even the combination of the practice of living in a wooded area or in a wild area, it doesn't have to be wooded, and observing, quiet observation of nature, it changes you. It reorients you in a way that is very primitive and wonderful, and I think it's part of what is needed to help humans to change themselves in order to live a better life and also a better life for the planet. I just want to just briefly say you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. We're doing an interview today with Bernd Heinrich, and we're talking about his book, Life Everlasting. So, yeah, I think part of what also is helpful is not only for classes to be taught in biology and whatnot, but also to get kids out in nature and have them actually put their hands in the dirt and observe things, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I think reading the abstract in the book is not going to do it. You have to have the actual hands-on experience. I mean, certainly that was with me. Everything was hands-on. There wasn't any such thing as toys. You know, I looked at caterpillars and beetles and birds. But that doesn't mean that I am averse to books and reading. I have a huge, huge library and I read a lot. I think it's very important to be informed. But I think it starts with simple things, like going out there and seeing what there is, and connecting it with emotions, with feelings, and familiarity. And this is something that is becoming less and less, and we need to make a conscious effort to rectify it, to get kids out there but I see a lot of movement toward that direction, so I am hopeful.
The book is full of stories about different insects and animals and birds and wildlife and fish and salmon and whatnot. And they're very surprising and wonderful stories. They're like reading little short stories, in fact, because they all have such purpose. Everybody has this purpose, you know, and this interaction with each other and all that. Is there anything that, I know you have a new book that's just come out called The Homing, which is about the way that animals seek home and find home, but is there anything in all your years of studying wildlife and looking at it so carefully and so meditatively, is there anything that really surprised you?
I think I get surprised all the time. I mean, I can... For example, just a month ago, I was really, really surprised about how an iris flower opened. I had never seen anything like that. It was one of the European yellow irises I got by some strange reason. I had been looking at blue flag irises, the native irises with bumblebee pollination, and I saw the flower open, In basically a second, the bud is a one knotted bud, and suddenly, boom, it was all open. I'd never seen the intermediate before, and I happened to be watching swallows at a box where I sit for hours, and there was the flowers right beside me, and I suddenly looked down, and there was a bud, and the next second I looked over, and the flower was totally expanded in all directions. And so how that opened was just totally, totally surprising, and this just happened in this a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm. That's so wonderful. No, I agree that if you look, there's surprises everywhere. I this morning was having a cup of tea on facing the river, and I heard an acorn woodpecker, and I haven't heard them for a while. They're around in these woods.
Uh-huh.
And I looked up, and it was, of course, a blue jay sitting on the fence imitating mm-hmm. an acorn woodpecker. And as I told you once before when we spoke, I also have had them imitate sounds I make, like if I'm calling my pet, you know, my animal, my cat, I'll meow because he likes to be meowed to. So now when I do that, a blue jay will come by and go, meow.
Wow.
They're so mimetic. And these are, blue jays are, you know, usually you don't, when you put food out for birds, you think, oh, let's not feed the blue jays because they'll interfere with other birds' nests and they do all, they're aggressive and they're this and that, but they're so complex. They're very complex, intelligent birds, and they're very interesting to watch. And you constantly get surprised by the things that you think might not be good, that actually they have a place in the forest. They have a place.
Exactly. There's so many stories. Everything that you watch closely enough, after a while, you'll see a story in it. And I think that's true for me after watching anything for a while. There's some interesting things pop up that leave me with questions, and the questions then lead to stories, and including blue jays. I've also been watching here for the last several years, for example. Sometimes I see groups of them flying, and and they're all silent, and I don't know where they're going. And other times I see individuals, and they're making a lot of noise, and I don't know why they're making it. I don't see any other bird around. What the heck is going on? Sometimes they mimic one hawk, and sometimes they mimic another hawk.
Yeah, they're good at that.
I don't know what's going on. So
There's a nice book written by John Young called What the Robin Knows, which is about what the bird sounds, the various bird sounds mean, like what's an alarm call, what's a mating call, what's a song, what's a, you know. So, and it is the case, like you just said, if you hear a lot of racket, you wonder if a predator has walked into the area somewhere. If you've got, and the advantage to that is if you're very quiet, you might be able to spot something that's very shy, like a fox or something. But that, the, you know, and in my case, sometimes it's just the cat and they're screaming, or they're just warning me that this is their territory, you know.
Exactly, and that's what I've been interested in. This one story I've been interested in with respect to ravens. I hear this call, and ever since I was a kid, it's sort of common knowledge or common woods lore that when you hear a blue jay scream, that there is, it's alerting to some kind of a predator.
Yep.
But at this point, I found out that for the most part, that's not true. There's nothing else around there. And that's what makes it fascinating. I think there's kind of a networking going on with others that they keep track of that are widely separated, so that they're kind of a networking thing.
I think so too, because I certainly saw that here when there was an animal down and the ravens showed up because they were calling each other and there was a call and response thing, and they were very complicated vocalizations, including a sound that sounds like someone hitting a large hollow bamboo tube, you know, a kind of talk sound that they use. And at one point I was sitting by the river and I heard the raven. They're very hard to see. They hide. They're shy. But you can see them flying, and then they do these aerial acrobatics and stuff. But this one was in the tree, in a redwood. It was very tall. It's a very tall tree. And I couldn't see him, and I kept looking. So I started making the vocalizations back to him, and maybe her. And I got return calls and things. And then after a long time, at one point, one of them finally came down to a place where I could see them. And this is such a large bird that when they fly overhead, you feel like a pterodactyl has just flown over your head. They're easily the size of a turkey buzzard. You know, they're really big birds, and blue-black, exquisitely beautiful birds. And as you pointed out, they're very playful.
So, very playful.
Yeah. How did you, you know, in your book about ravens, you actually raised some of them. What kind of advice do you have for people who are listening to this interview about interacting with wildlife and not, you know, interacting without disturbing, have a relationship with them without disturbing them in some way? Do you have any advice?
I think that's the ideal, if you can get it. I mean, I have been watching swallows in the bird box, you know, and they're coming back to the same box, and they gradually got used to me, and I can watch them really up close without disturbing them at all. The ideal is so that you are just like a post or a tree that they can totally ignore. So that you can really see the intimate interactions with each other and see what really is going. But of course, you know, as a scientist, sometimes you have to actually, you know, cage them, which I really hate. But that's just the cost of getting the information. Information is not cheap, and so of course one tries to do it in such a way that there's the least inconvenience to the animals.
And, I would say so, yeah.
I've had ravens and aviaries, and we've learned so much from them that we didn't know before. It opened up a whole new chapter. But I had aviaries that were huge, where they could fly around, and I would never think of putting a raven in a little cage like a canary or something.
No. Or
even one, you know, that's 10 by 20 feet. That's still too small. They need big cages if they're going to be caged. And you know, different animals have different requirements and different needs. And you only learn that by really getting to know them well. And it involves cost. So, you know, for kids to handle animals, that is a small cost to the animal, and sometimes a larger cost. But I think without that intimate contact, it's very difficult to really get to know them.
Well, for instance, people on around this area have said to me, "Don't feed the ravens because they'll come down and they'll start pecking on your house, or they'll peck on your car, and they're very destructive." No. So you shouldn't feed them. And there's always a question about which animals, you know, I think you can feed some animals far away from your house. You walk a distance and leave things for them instead of putting it right by your house. But then there's also people who have rescued fawns or deer who were injured and then took care of them, and then the fawn came adapted to them, but went back into the wild and did bring their babies back. But then other people say, oh, you should never let them become comfortable with you because then they won't be afraid of humans and they'll get killed. Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, exactly. This is a problem. We try to make generalities where we put animals into one bag, like animal is an animal. Animal is not an animal. We're an animal, too. We wouldn't want to be treated the same way as we treat a pig or whatever, you know. Each animal has its very own different needs, and there should be distinctions made. What animal under what conditions? If you have blanket rules, don't touch animals, don't feed animals, that's ridiculous. You got to talk about which animals at what time and where.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like everything else in life, there's always a context. Yeah, there's always a context. And as far as pigs go, they're fascinating too because they're social and they're intelligent. Animals, they're very complex animals. This is the problem, huh? This is the thing about having to incorporate living creatures into yourself. And as you say, it you accumulate a debt. If you're going to do that, whether it's plants that are living or animals that are living, you accumulate a debt. And what your book is promising is that if you repay the debt by feeding the earth with your own body and by making sure that your own life practices don't destroy the balance, that you compost, that you leave trees down, you allow habitat, you keep restoring the soil, and you, in the end, donate yourself back into the soil, that's a way to pay back this precious gift that you had of life, of sharing this with everybody.
Yes, exactly. We exert a cost, and it's inevitable. You know, we kill. We have to kill, and we have to, you know, and there's some way, you know, just giving thanks is nice verbally, but you know, also doing something is better.
Well, some people would argue you don't have to kill, but I think that the slippery slope with that is that I've been a gardener in a large garden, and I've raised vegetables for consumption, and I'm here to tell you that things die when you farm, and things also die when you cut a plant down to harvest it. If you cut it down to its quick to get a full harvest, you are killing the plant, and I really felt it after raising them from seedlings. I felt it very powerfully, so I don't think that we can have life without death. I think that's just the way it is.
That's just the way it is. I mean, if you live off corn, just imagine all you've destroyed the prairies. You've destroyed so many, many animals that live on the prairies. You know, being a vegetarian is not going to reduce killing, hardly any at all. It's going to mean habitat destruction for growing things, and never mind killing the plants, but what about all the animals that would have lived there instead?
Yeah, certainly so. Well, in your book, The Homing, you must get into some of this too, because as soon as you start establishing territory as a human, your homing instinct can impact very powerfully on other living creatures in areas. So it's always important, I think, to think very carefully about the materials you're using and how you're building and whether you have a lot of fences and where you live and how it works.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't go into that to a great extent in The Homing Instinct, but that's more part of the life everlasting.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes. So now that you've completed the book, The Homing Instinct, what's the next project for you?
Well, as I just mentioned, I had been watching tree swallows, and I think there are so many stories in that relate to individuals. There are so many individual differences. If you look at individual ravens, when people ask me, you know, what do ravens do? I always say, well, which raven are you talking about? Under what condition?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where the interesting stories are, is when you, once you start to look at individuals, how the individuals interact. So I'm, you know, working on a book of individual birds that I've known, from mostly birds that are available to be seen by, you know, common birds, available to be seen by most people in their backyards. If they put up, you know, berry bushes, if they put up bird boxes, make it convenient for them to be there. And it's a way of getting to know them better. And so, and for me, it's also included some pets that I've had, but mostly it's wild birds that I've been compelled to try to get to know after I've had, you know, live animals close to me as a kid. You know, I had pet crows. You know, I never had them in a cage ever. I just, they were always free. Followed me around and got to know them as individuals, and you learn something about their character. Mm-hmm. But you can also do that in the wild, and that's what I'm trying to do in writing a book about these experiences.
Well, I'll be looking forward to that, because I'm also trying to do that. I'm trying to find a way to be close and observe and interact without interfering, which is tricky. I'm right now trying to coax the chickadees down to my property because winter's coming and I know how hungry they are, and I can hear them in the trees around. They haven't, once they come, they're very friendly. They're not scared, but until they get to you, it takes a while to get them to come, to coax them down. So that's fun.
I have chickadees here too, and I'm very enamored by them.
The chickadees?
Chickadees,
They're amazing because of what they have to do to survive the winter. They don't migrate. In the book I told you about, the What the Robin Knows, that he talks about the chickadees and the fantastic energy expenditure. Well, there are other books that talk about them as well. Actually, they're actually no, I tell a lie. It's the other book is One Square Inch. What is it? The book, Jeffrey, the book by the biologist. Well, anyway, he observes a small patch of ground for 15 minutes every day in an old-growth forest, and he talks about different... It's a lovely book. So we're just about out of time. I understand also that you do some kind of yearly event with people where you take them out in nature. Is that something you want people to have contact information for?
No.
Oh, no, okay.
Not.
It's all word of mouth.
I mean,
okay.
No. It's a class.
Oh, it's a class.
I teach a class, and it's limited to 10 students.
Oh, okay.
And they're from the University of Vermont.
Got it. Okay. Well, I get it. Okay. And my memory is also that you don't give out any information, but your books, you know, are astonishing, and you keep writing them. And the one we've been talking about today is Life Everlasting, The Animal Way of Death. It won a Penn New England Award. It's a wonderful book, and all of your other books as well. So thank you again so much for this time and this interview. I so appreciate your work, Bernd Heinrich. Again, thank you for this time.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Jeffrey, are you going to... I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Find a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you'd like to reach us, email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.